This is an ABC podcast.
Dr. Kiri Bilby's talk coming up has some charming myths about human reproduction. Some of us heard about even wilder ones when growing up. But maybe we've become emancipated from red-faced explanations from our parents or sagittal diagrams with arrows from our teachers. Kiri Bilby graduated with a degree from Sydney University and went to the ANU, the Australian National University in Canberra, and now does teaching in embryology at Monash. Here's her address on nuns' urine and big pharma, given at Museums Victoria.
So, making babies. We all know how to make babies. We're all adults. I will give you a quick recap, just in case. There'll be an exam at the end of today. So when a man and a woman really love each other, like really love each other, they decide to form a partnership, a commitment. They might spend an evening out celebrating. And on the way home, they may stop in a cabbage patch and pick up an infant. That's one way it can be done. Now, it's not always easy to find a cabbage patch, especially in urban areas such as Melbourne, so delivery is sometimes required. There's stalks available to do that, no problem. So these are some of the kind of stories that we used to tell ourselves or tell our children a long time ago when reproduction was probably not as well understood, when it was a bit embarrassing, when it was socially stigmatised and at worst even shameful. But today we have a much better understanding of how reproduction and fertility evolve. We have a much more comfortable relationship with sex and sexuality in our society. We have books for children like Where Did I Come From, which very clearly and sometimes maybe too clinically tell our children that sperm shoots out of the man's penis and into the woman's vagina, rushes through the cervix, into the uterus, takes a left or a right, goes into a fallopian tube, and the first one there is the one that's going to make the baby. So congratulations, everybody. You're all winners tonight, just for being here. So we have this narrative now that we work with. But we also have a new narrative, and it's something that's only evolved in the past, 20 to 30 years, more commonly. In Australia, one in six couples now seek treatment for infertility. And so statistically, this means that there'll be maybe two or three children in every classroom these days that was not born from sexual congress. So we can throw away this book, Where Did I Come From? Instead, we have to think about what their narrative is about conception. And they were conceived through assisted reproductive technologies, or IVF, in vitro fertilization, commonly and affectionately branded by the media as test tube babies. So we have this entirely different way of thinking about conception. Now, what is causing this increase in IVF use? Essentially, what it is that couples are waiting longer to have children. And we can think about this in a certain way. We can think about the natural progression of fertility when you don't use contraceptives. So if we're taking a woman who has no access to contraception, possibly sub-Saharan Africa, Kalahari, she will start to reproduce when she's in her mid to late teens. She'll have five or six children, and by the time she hits her early 30s to late 30s, her reproductive lifespan will finish. Now, if we contrast that to what's happening in modern-day Australia, women are taking contraceptives from their late teens, and they're starting to plan their family when they get into their early to mid-30s. So we can see that there's this natural conflict between what's happening with natural fertility and what's happening with the fertility that we rely on through society or the constructs that we put around fertility. So as such, fertility treatment has become this increasing demand, and we're seeing it starting to be a really big business. IVF is quite an expensive technology. And it brings in quite a bit of cash. I think Australia was estimated at grossing about $550 million in revenue last year through the use of ART. Now, supporting this industry, we have a whole gamut of pharmaceutical and medical device companies. They produce drugs, they produce consumables, they produce equipment, anything that you need to make an embryo outside of the human body. In particular, they produce hormones, and these hormones are used to stimulate the ovary to produce numerous eggs within a cycle that would usually only produce a single egg. Now, today, most of the drugs that you can get on the market, they're something called recombinant. So they are synthesized in a lab, and they're made artificially to replicate what the body is naturally producing to do some of these things. But before we had the ability to be able to synthesize these hormones, we used to have to extract them from somewhere, animals, people, whatever. And most commonly, one that I'm thinking of in particular, was extracted from the urine of women. More specifically, the urine of postmenopausal Catholic nuns. Pretty niche, right? So how do we get to postmenopausal Catholic nuns? I was quite interested to find in doing a bit of research for this that nuns have been used quite heavily throughout history for scientific research. And there's actually good reasons for this. As ironic as it sounds, they're a very homogenous group to study. They usually have very similar health status, similar diets, similar exercise patterns, fewer bad habits, none pun intended, thank you. And best of all, they are altruistic, so they want to help. It's very hard to get people to sign up for clinical trials, but these ladies are already on board. So nuns have been used to demonstrate some pretty interesting things. One of my favourite was the health benefits of drinking alcohol. Yeah, I would have liked to have been a nun in that study. In Spain, 50 nuns were asked to drink half a litre of beer every day for 45 days, and the ones that had high cholesterol at the start of the trial had much lower cholesterol at the end of the trial. So I don't know if they were relaxed or anything, but that's all the information I need to get on board with that. Now, perhaps more logically, nuns have been used to study the effects of childbearing on women because they're a cohort that don't have children. And so we've seen studies that show that having children does not increase your chances of incontinence. We've seen studies that show that not having children does increase your chance of breast cancer. So there's been some interesting observations that have been made. Essentially, what we know from nuns is that we should drink beer and have kids. That's probably the bottom line there. So back to the having kids thing. What does this sister act, second one in there, have to do with Big Pharma and making babies in the 21st century? So I'd like to introduce a scientist to you by the name of Dr. Pierre Donini, who was employed by a company called Serono. So they're now called Merck Serono, and they're one of the largest pharmaceutical manufacturers in the world today. Now, he was hired to extract and purify a hormone called follicle stimulating hormone, or FSH. And this is extracted from the urine of women and used to stimulate the ovary. Now, he initially went straight to pregnant women, thinking that this would be the best source of FSH. Of course, a pregnant woman has no need to stimulate the ovary. So he later found out that it was actually postmenopausal women who had the highest levels of FSH because their ovary had shut down, the pituitary was still producing FSH, but it wasn't getting used or there was no negative feedback coming in. So there was more FSH floating around the body. So he figured out he had to use urine from postmenopausal women. Now, enter another guy called Bruno Lunenfeld. He's a Viennese-born, Israeli-educated medical student working in Geneva who is researching the use of human hormones to stimulate pregnancy. Now, this guy hears about Donini's work and he wants to get on board. The main reason is that he's motivated to try and increase the Jewish population after the Holocaust. So he tries to see what he can do to help out Donini as a clinician helping a scientist. And what he finds is that they're going to need a ton of urine to get this thing off the ground, right? They're going to need litres and litres to produce the treatments for a proper clinical trial. So, enter Giulio Pacelli. They're all very well connected back in Italy back then. A friend of Lunenfeld, an Italian aristocrat, executive at Serono, and this is the most important point, he's the nephew of the Pope. Yeah. I bet we're all going to go home and reevaluate our networking on LinkedIn, get rid of Gary from accounting and try and get the Pope on board. So he spoke to the Pope. The Pope said, yeah, you can have the urine from all my nuns in retirement villages in the Vatican. And soon enough, there were tanker trucks brimming with the pee of hundreds of nuns from Catholic retirement homes across the nation, speeding on the M Uno to our headquarters in Rome. So it took about 10 nuns, 10 days, to produce enough urine for a single treatment. So you can imagine that that's quite a lot of pee. The first baby born from the resulting treatment was in 1962 in Tel Aviv. So we see the urine of Catholic nuns being used to boost the Jewish population. Now, meanwhile, in the UK, in aiming to solve a totally different reproductive barrier, Dr. Bob Edwards and his team introduced IVF to the world in 1978. He was trying to literally bypass the fallopian tube, which he was seeing was blocked in particular cases of infertility. And so in doing this, the idea was to use Donini's drug to stimulate the ovary, to pick up eggs, and then to fertilise these eggs in a dish, transferring embryos back to the prospective mother. This worked really well, and in partnership with Donini, we started to see Serono's share value skyrocket. Suddenly, there was just so much demand for this drug across the world with clinics that were starting to pick up IVF. So this really boosted demand and it really boosted profit, and it's allowed us to now invest in looking at recombinant versions of these hormones so we can see how this whole development is taking place. I really like this story because it shows the value of collaboration. So it shows collaboration between a scientist and a clinician. It shows collaboration between nations. It shows collaboration between industry and academia. It shows collaboration between Catholicism and Judaism. And it shows collaboration between altruism and commercial gain. And I think it's a really nice way of looking at how we can be accumulatively productive, even if we have really diverse individual motivations. Okay, so today IVF has become a standard treatment for couples experiencing infertility. Each year, hundreds of thousands of children are conceived from the legacy of postmenopausal nuns in Italy. Now, this new tale of creation may not contain the same kind of romantic, enigmatic, or slightly quirky storyline of the past, but I think that the historical and scientific details are as intriguing and almost as inconceivable. Thank you.
Yes, Kiri, sometimes when you hear what happened way back in history, you wonder how our forebears ever managed to conceive the next generation. Dr. Kiri Bilby climbs mountains, swims like a dolphin, and even, you'll now know this, does comedy when not coordinating a course in clinical embryology at Monash. She was speaking at the Museum of Victoria. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.